Wi-Fi. It's fit conveniently into the lives of many. Increasingly, we carry small devices that connect to the internet anywhere Wi-Fi happens. We don't really give much thought to how it happens. Today, an Alaskan who did. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Some Alaskan old-timers will recognize the name of our guest today, Alex Hills. Our number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. We're talking with communications pioneer Alex Hills today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, I'm celebrating my 50th year in broadcasting right about now, September 1961. I got into broadcasting, and I've been at, I guess, 8 major stations and another dozen or so besides. And one thing I've discovered in working for a broadcast outlet is the best stations are the ones that are managed by people that came out of the technical area. They're the best GMs. The best GMs used to be chief engineers. That's much better than a general manager that comes out of sales, and it's much better than a general manager that comes out of some other industry. And we have one of those with us today. So, Alex Hills, it's really a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Alex Hills is a founder of some public broadcasting outlets in Alaska, including KOTZ, KSKA, and indeed, I guess you were pretty involved also with the Bethel station, right? KYUK?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So it's great to have you here.
Thanks. The reason I was both general manager and chief engineer was because they only had enough money to hire one guy.
I totally know. I totally know. But the fact of the matter is that your background is in the technical area.
That's right.
Because of that, you have steadfastly been involved in pioneering technological developments. And that's why you're here, because you wrote this book, Wi-Fi and the Bad Boys of Radio, Dawn of a Wireless Technology.
That's it.
And it's actually a kind of a short book. But yet, I guess because of your involvement with Wi-Fi from the very early years, you were able to, you've even written this up for like Scientific American. I mean, you've learned how to interpret the rather complicated technology involved with this for the ordinary person.
Right. That's right. A lot of ordinary people really do get turned off by hearing about technology. They like to use it, though, right? A wise person once told me, when you add the first equation into your article, you've just lost half your audience. And the second one, you lose half of the audience that's still left. So there is kind of a knack to writing about this stuff in a way that's intelligible. And I've written for Scientific American and some other similar publications, and people seem to like it. There are a lot of people out there who, although they're not engineers or technical experts, they're kind of interested in this stuff. And those are the people that like to read some of the things I've written.
Alex Hills is with us. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. He's one of the RF guys. You have several different kinds of technical people. One kind of technical people is kind of a bench guy. This is the person that works with soldering irons and things like that. Then there's the RF guy. And these can be women, too. When I say guy, I could easily be a woman. who work with the radio waves. They're into the propagation, where the radio waves go and what they do. And boy, is Alex Hills ever one of those. Because that's what Wi-Fi is. You describe it. I mean, Wi-Fi, I guess, the center of the book. The book starts in Alaska. It ends in Alaska. But the center of the book, and really the core of the book, is developments that took place in the 90s at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And basically, these are your basic geeks who get tired of plugging their computers in and want to be able to use them wherever they are.
That's it. We're geeks. There's no doubt about it.
And you describe at one point this, it's not a robot, but it's basically kind of a little wagon that you designed that would measure field strength, which is one of your basic RF measurements, and would go around and you could map a location by running kind of this shopping cart around, and it would map out how your radio signals were overlapping.
Right.
That's the damnedest thing.
That was one of my inventions, and that was one of the examples about how necessity is the mother of invention, because it's kind of toward the end of the story after we'd built the first Wi-Fi network and so on, but we developed a design method to position access points, or what some people would call wireless routers, in a way that would provide complete coverage of an area. We had a great design method, but it was very labor intensive. It took lots of hours to do measurements and figure out how the signals were propagating.
Yeah, well, it's because you have basically a blueprint, which is two dimensions,
mm-hmm.
and you've got the radios is going all different dimensions. And so, you know, there's not a real good three-dimensional way of doing that.
So so we had this design method that worked really well. We had people coming from other universities to find out how we had figured out how to do all this stuff. But what I realized was that when this got out into the larger world, like the corporate world, and other people outside of universities started to design these networks, they didn't have a lot of students around as cheap labor to handle the labor-intensive part of this. So that was the inspiration for the cart, which was called Rollabout, and later became a commercial product. The idea here was you just push the cart. Well, if you set up some access points as a trial, as a test case, then you push the cart around, and it automatically creates a coverage map. And that was kind of the inspiration of that one. It worked pretty well.
Yeah, and so why ain't you rich? Or are you?
Yeah, you know, there is this idea that you just get an idea, you get a patent, and you instantly get rich. Real life isn't really quite that simple. There are lots of trials, failures. The loop is sort of try to find a solution, fail, try again, fail, try again, fail. And that's kind of how it goes in this business. Not too many people get rich, to tell the truth.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and one compelling thing I think about your story in Wi-Fi and the Bad Boys of Radio is that throughout there's a collaborative process. I mean, it's not like you're sitting there in your lab coat, you know, torturing your brain to get a solution. It's basically a bunch of people, you know, over coffee or beers or whatever, trying to solve problems. And enjoying and relishing that process as only, mm-hmm. you know, the Carnegie Mellon geeks could.
As in the stories about solving the problem on the napkin in the fast food restaurant or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But actually, you know, building the first Wi-Fi network, originally the problem we were trying to solve was a much smaller problem. And I think that's another thing that happens with innovation. You may start off trying to solve one problem, but end up doing something different, especially if you're driven by the market, driven by what people really want. So in our case, it was really a very small problem. We had some computer science researchers who wanted a little wireless testbed because they wanted to try out their software and do certain things with it. And that was all they asked for, just covering a couple floors of a building. That was it. So I went out and I looked at the products that were on the market, and this was in 1993, and there was really no product that was up to the job, but there were some products that were close. They were kind of in the right ballpark. They called them in those days wireless local area network equipment or wireless LAN equipment. So we bought some of that. We tried to set it up, tried to get it to work, and went through the try to find a solution, fail, try to find a solution. We went around that loop several times, finally got things to work a little bit, and that was the beginning of something that turned out to be a lot bigger.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, there was demand push or demand pull.
Demand pull, I think. What the moment of revelation for me was when I discovered that there were some people on the network that I didn't know were people using the wireless network. It was supposed to just be for researchers. In fact, we had put some software controls in place to make sure that the access was restricted to the people that were supposed to be using it. The reason we did that was we were worried about having too many people on there. The network might become congested and not really be usable for its purpose. But Carnegie Mellon students are pretty smart kids, and they very quickly figured out a way to hack their way onto the network, and soon there were more students on there than researchers. So that was the demand pull part of the thing was, okay, if these kids are so excited about this, then maybe there's a bigger market. And then that was that was the moment when it became clear that we were really onto something.
And you were.
True.
There were, I'm fascinated by the different technologies that come into play in order to make this happen, to solve these problems. First off, that you would use more than one frequency. Second off, that there would be computers capable of seamlessly moving from one venue to another. And doing this thing that starts happening in the cyber world very early, when people are even designing chips, where you actually design in the less efficient way rather than the more efficient way to get the result. You actually, it's better if you're doing a process of elimination, don't do the elimination. You just go ahead and do them all. And it works better. And the same thing here. There were people at CMU that were able to design the software to move around to different sources and keep everything straight.
That was something that we got onto fairly early, was the ability to hand off from one network to another. So there are actually a couple levels to this. One is the ability to hand off from one access point to another within the Wi-Fi network. And that was not part of that original product that I mentioned that we first latched onto. But it was obvious that as devices became more mobile, people would want to move around and remain connected to the network. So we had to work on getting that in place. Then another piece that was much more farsighted was we wanted, when people left the campus, left the range of the Wi-Fi network, we wanted them to be able to automatically be handed off to the local cellular network so that they could still remain connected. Now, this was about 15 years ago, more than 15 years ago that we were working on this, but it's now very familiar to anyone who uses a smartphone, which is, if you're at home or in your office and you are using the Wi-Fi network, then you leave and your device switches over and gets connected to 3G or 4G or whatever you have. That was one of those computer science professors that dreamed that one up. His name is David Johnson. And he had a project he started called the Monarch Project, which was an acronym for Mobile Network Architectures. But he was also recognizing the migratory behavior of the monarch butterfly. And so, anyway, that was how that all came to pass.
Wow. Do you think there was a rivalry going on? I mean, some of these people moved on. I mean, and there's centers now at like Rice for sure, and MIT's. MIT's been there probably longer, really, than CMU. Mm-hmm. But I mean, is there a kind of rivalry between these different campuses and these?
It's not kind of a rivalry. It's a rivalry. By the way, that guy David Johnson that I mentioned, who came up with this seamless switching, he moved to Rice University. That's where he is now.
Right.
As far as MIT, the rivalry between Carnegie Mellon and MIT is classic. We call ourselves we say that MIT is the Carnegie Mellon of Massachusetts, for example.
Yeah. Well, and you yourself, you went to Rensselaer.
Right. I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic.
And this is, how would you characterize that in the spectrum of these technical colleges?
Oh, it's right in there. at each year, you know, the ratings come out and some move up and some move down. Right now, Carnegie Mellon is number one in the world for computer science.
I had no idea.
And also for robotics. So in the robotic area, we've got that autonomous vehicle that drives itself with no human involvement. It's a red Hummer. It drove itself all the way across the United States.
Oh, my God. And that you're telling me that's street legal?
What we did was we put a human being in the driver's seat. It kept law enforcement happy, yeah.
So we're speaking with Alex Hills. He is a distinguished service professor, or the distinguished service professor?
There are others.
At Carnegie Mellon University. And yet, you're able to do this largely remotely from Alaska now?
Right. I spend part-time at Pittsburgh. I also teach in a university in the south of Chile and get around quite a bit.
Wow. You certainly do. And you continue to push the technology area?
Oh, absolutely.
And
yeah.
your graduate students as well?
Right. What I've been doing lately is working with students in developing nations. So I don't think we talked about this earlier, but I have students that work on projects in developing nations around the world, always technology projects, and they volunteer to do that. It always turns out to be a great experience for them.
Do you have been in the frontiers of technology? You were bringing technology really to rural Alaska at an earlier point in your career. Right. This obviously has to be something that you believe in. Do you think, I remember Buckminster Fuller long ago saying, look, if you, the underdeveloped world is where you want to put the technological innovations because they don't have to go through all the bad experiments we already had.
We call it leapfrogging.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a great modern example of that. This past summer, I had some students working in Africa, in the nation of Rwanda. But Africa as a whole is a great example of this leapfrogging phenomenon. Let's take telecom. If you don't have all that old infrastructure in place that you have to continue to support, it gives you the flexibility to jump ahead to the new technology. And in Africa, they have a huge deployment of cellular telephones, wireless telephones. They were way behind a couple decades ago. They were way behind in getting landline service out there. They didn't have all that landline stuff to worry about, so they just jumped right ahead to cellular. And, you know, everybody, well, it's true here now, but years ago when cellular phones were not as widely used here, they were very widely used in Africa because of just that reason.
Let me ask you this. The way I see it, there always seems to be a big cloud of nonsense that comes into all of any new communication capability that comes in. I'll give you an example. We're starting to see the internet get kind of clotted up with because people want movies. And the wireless internet get clotted up because people want to be able to download movies onto handheld devices. Is there no end to this?
There doesn't seem to be any end to the demand for bandwidth. That seems to be universal. And that's really what 4G cellular technology is about, is getting the bandwidth up. Wi-Fi goes faster than cellular technologies, but the cellular guys are pushing real hard to catch up for the reason that you just mentioned. Right now, it's video. That's the latest great thing.
And it just, you wonder where it's going to end. I mean, who really cares whether the movie is high resolution or not? And they probably could put up with all sorts of pixelation when it's that big. Mm-hmm. It's just a little teeny thing the size of a postage stamp.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't really matter.
You know, I wonder if you know that low-power television was pioneered right here in Alaska. You were talking about pioneering technology.
It's amazing. And I don't think we've seen, that's not even, the whole low-power thing is probably going to have a renaissance.
I think so. Now it's officially on the books with the FCC. You can go out, you can get a license from the FCC to set up a 10-watt or 100-watt television station that just serves your neighborhood or your little local area. But before anyone outside in the South 48 had thought of that, we were already doing it up here in order to take care of some of our villages. Then the FCC saw what we did, and then they picked it up as an official service, low-power television.
It's been pretty handy having Ted Stevens around, hasn't it?
That's true. He helped us a lot.
He really did. I mean, I know when we had our Bush messages were technically illegal until Ted Stevens twisted the arm of the FCC, say. But, I mean, we all know how important those things are. You even write a little bit about it in your in the first chapter of your book, because it's still all over the Bush.
Sure. The different stations, it seems like every station has a different name for it.
Right.
At KOTZ, we call them Tundra Telegrams. Sometimes it's Caribou Clatter or Village Hotline, something like that.
Right, yeah.
Still alive and well.
Yeah, the trap line.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be, when I first came here in the 80s, it was still on the Anchorage. Some of the Anchorage stations had them, but I'm not hearing them anymore. But, yeah, it's true. And over again, we've seen developments take place in Alaska that then spread over the rest of the world. You know, the satellite dish, some stuff with the satellite dishes.
Oh, the small earth stations is a great example. Started happening in the mid-70s. At that time, a satellite earth station was a huge installation like the one they have up at Talkeetna called the Bartlett Earth Station. And that's a 30-meter antenna, plus or minus. And there were
I think we got a 7 on top of this building.
Yeah.
You don't need that big a dish for anything anymore.
Well, it turned out there was a better or at least a more economical way to do it, and that was the small earth stations, the ones that went into the villages in the mid to late 70s. Those were 4.5 meters. So, you know, about half the diameter, but really far lower in cost. And that was the way that was used to get some kind of modern communication services out to the villages. But we were the first place in the world to do a large-scale deployment of those small satellite earth stations. I think I might have told you earlier that several years later, I was at a conference, and I ran into the communications minister of French Polynesia. He was worried about communications to small islands over a vast expanse of the Pacific. And he told me, we have a great idea. We're going to start to roll out these small earth stations. And I had to break the news to him that he wasn't the first.
No. We're talking with Alex Hills, a broadcasting pioneer, wireless technology pioneer, and so forth. And we're finding out that Wi-Fi has roots in Alaska and much else. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. An email talk@alaskapublic.org. Brian has a question that I have absolutely no idea, but you may know, Alex. He says, is White Spaces Radio, which is also known as 802.22, going to be a solution soon for small Alaska communities? Do you know what that is?
I do not know about 802.22. Sorry, Brian. Maybe I can look that one up.
Right. I figured that almost had to be a plant. But you weren't able to knock it out of the park. I'm shocked. Wi-Fi and the bad boys of radio, dawn of a wireless technology. Alex Hills is our guest. And Alex, when I saw the title, I figured the bad boys of radio, hey, man. I know a lot of bad boys from radio, but that's not what you're talking about.
People always ask me if I'm one of the bad boys.
Yeah, or some geeks over at CMU. But that's not it either. Nor is it people in Bush, Alaska, some of the rascals that have been in and out of community radio in Alaska. That's not it either.
Some people think both of us are bad boys, I think.
Bad boys of radio. Gene Shepard, Wolfman Jack.
Bob and Ray.
Yeah. But that's not it. When you say bad boys of radio, you're talking RF. You're talking the characteristics of the broadcast signal.
The bad boys are the radio gremlins. The little pranksters that get in there and mess up your reception, whether it's for Wi-Fi or cellular or FM broadcast, AM broadcast, those radio waves do funny things, and those are the bad boys.
When you were starting out in broadcasting, did you go right, was it at Rensselaer or before?
Well, let's see. It was at Rensselaer. I did ham radio before Rensselaer.
It was ham. Of course, it was ham.
Ham radio, yeah.
So you came across the bad boys right away.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So tell me about
it. The bad boys, and sometimes the bad boys helped me by making my signal skip all the way, halfway around the world, but then other times it didn't. So there was a reliability issue there. As I say, at one point in the book, when Alaska villages were dependent on shortwave radio, they didn't really quite get the fun or the adventure part of it that I did as a ham, because I was excited when a signal would suddenly come in that I didn't expect, and then I'd be talking to someone new. But if you're a village health aide, depending on that same service, you're not really into the adventure of it so much as you'd like to have a reliable connection. And that was why we came along with the satellite earth stations, in order to make things more reliable. But the bad boys, yeah. So the bad boys are the guys that it's just a metaphor for all the funny things that happen with radio signals. And in order to get a system to work reliably, you have to figure out a way to make things work in spite of the bad boys.
You do. And you had to, particularly when you're dealing with lower power and you're dealing with these routers or access points, and you're doing Wi-Fi, the problems are everywhere. For one thing, they reflect. They're blocked. So you don't get too far from where the signal originates, and it starts getting messed with.
Right. Wi-Fi signals are very low power. They're unlicensed. So in order to run an unlicensed service, the FCC requires that they run at very low power levels. Right, so shadowing, which you call blocking just now, is one of the real bad boys. That's the one where if you have some substantial object in between point A and point B, the signal probably isn't going to get through that object. Especially if it's made of metal, and the object effectively casts a shadow, just like a light shadow. If you're in that shadow with your smartphone, you're not going to get service. So that's one of the problems in designing these networks, is to place the access points or the transmitters in places that will get rid of those shadows.
And yet, oddly, sometimes a signal will get places you never dreamed it would get to.
Isn't that amazing? We
it's the damnedest thing.
Yep.
But anyways, I mean, if you're in the industry, you notice it probably more than if you're not. But anyone traveling in a vehicle is basically as a signal strength detector there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you go and you have an FM and there's the tower, and you drive to where there's a hill between you and the tower, and all of a sudden you don't get the signal, or you go into a tunnel and it ain't there. And yet AM is not going to work that way.
Yep.
That's actually traveling along the line. So that's actually following the bends and the curves.
Right, that's the ground wave signal. Right.
Yeah.
So that was part of the mastery of what's going on with all these bad boys and all these radio signals, is it depends which frequency you're on. If you're on the AM band, it's one story. And if you're on the FM band or a higher frequency, it's a much different story.
Yeah, and then they started. I mean, what seems to be happening is they keep busting into higher and higher frequencies, and the higher frequencies they have some trade-offs. But at the same time, I guess you can do more with less power, stuff like that.
And also, it also goes back to the bandwidth thing that you mentioned earlier, where people want to go faster and faster. They want to send video to their smartphones and things like that. that's one of the things that pushes us to the higher frequencies. But the higher frequencies are more difficult to deal with. The signals don't travel as far. They're more likely to be blocked or shadowed. So it's a trade-off, like you said.
Yeah, it's a trade-off. I always enjoyed listening to hams for a while, but then I would get bored because they never seemed to have anything to talk about except their how well signals were coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
But one thing I noticed that they would do is they would agree to switch frequencies. When things got fuzzy on one frequency, they'd say, well, you know, 40 meter. And then they'd just do it.
Mm-hmm. They say a ham can never be cured.
Oh, my. He's in show business now, folks. Alex Hills, broadcasting pioneer, is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
Alex Hills, Distinguished Service Professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and a former public radio general manager and chief engineer, and one of the inventors of wireless networks, is with us on this edition of Talk of Alaska. He's written a book, Wi-Fi and the Bad Boys of Radio, but he has a long background in Alaska, starting public radio stations and bringing telephone connectivity and small satellite dishes to rural communities. So I'm sure a number of people listening right now, Alex, all over the state who remember you. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, 550-8422. Email is talk at alaskapublic.org. And we'll go to the phones with George and Aniak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Alex Hills. George?
Yes, welcome. I'm retired in Aniak. I was part of the grandfather team with RCA that installed most of the satellite earth stations in Alaska, including the 10-meter ones, Barrow, Kotzebue, Adak, ta-da-da-da. But just my comment that, God, who would have known with this advance in electronics, but it seems like there is a big war going on between electronics and chemistry, and only God knows when it's going to end. Thank you. Goodbye.
Electronics and chemistry.
I'm not sure if George and I cross trails out there or not. Is right. George still on?
No, he made his comment and said goodbye from Aniak. But he's a member of 10-meter dishes. And I guess when RCA, there was RCA, there was GCI. Before that, where there was Alascom. Alascom and GCI kind of had a competition for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, there was RCA.
Mm-hmm.
And there was RCA Alascom, and then there was the military.
Right. So
it started with the military.
It originally started with the military, and up until 1971, the Air Force, well, first the Army and then later the Air Force, had something called the Alaska Communication Systems, which is different from the company that's now called ACS. But the company name of the company was actually inspired by that original military system. But in 1971, RCA Corporation, the big RCA, bought the Alaska Communication System and then expanded it and provided more services to the civilian world. So in those days, it was called RCA Alaska Communications, and then that was shortened to RCA Alascom, and then later Alascom, and as you said, it went from there.
Now, I'm trying to place where you were at this time, and I'm seeing you in Kotzebue in the 70s. And then in the book, the next thing you're doing is hooking people up with a higher power VHF. Maybe you could tell us a little bit of how that worked, because this is before, really, they had the satellite dishes.
Right, exactly.
And maybe there were some of the bigger ones, like in Maryland, like that.
Exactly. Just like George said, there were the 10-meter dishes were, there were 10-meter dishes for sure, but those were the smallest ones. But before the smaller stations, and in order to try to take care of some of the villages that didn't have any phone service, RCA came up with a kind of a creative solution, which was to take VHF radios that were intended to be mounted in the trunk of your car to provide phone service. And this was before cellular, so this was a pre-cellular telephone system. And there were a small number of probably fairly well-to-do people that had this kind of equipment. Anyway, the bright idea was to take that equipment and to install it in a village in a fixed location in a cabinet powered by batteries, which were in turn charged by the local electrical system. And then so we used that VHF system to provide the first phone service to the villages, just one telephone per village. That's the way it was in the very earliest days of the small earth station, too. So you had the whole village sharing one telephone, and I'm sure some of your listeners can very well remember lining up at the village telephone in order to make a call.
There are still villages where there aren't that many telephones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then out in Kotzebue, we formed OTZ Telephone, which was one of the first telephone cooperatives to put a full telephone exchange behind that earth station. So then you had the capability to provide a phone for every home and business in the community.
It's actually not all that long for us to have come that far. There's really been quite the, mm-hmm. I mean, a decade makes a big difference in technology in Alaska. I guess it does everywhere now. But in Alaska, I mean, you just go back to the 70s and you find times when there were very rudimentary communication capabilities.
The 1970s saw a very remarkable change, and I'm sure George out in Aniak would agree with that, is at the beginning of the 1970s, there was really no communication service in the villages except for shortwave radio. And each village had maybe one or two radios. Maybe the health aide had one. And maybe, remember, Ween Air Alaska? A lot of times the Ween agent would have a shortwave radio. And that was it. We didn't even have any public broadcasting stations out there. Maybe you could get a signal to skip in from Anchorage or Fairbanks at night. At the end of the 70s, most villages had, because of those small earth stations, had not only telephone service, but also television service coming in and being broadcast through the low-power transmitters. And then the public radio stations had been established in places like Bethel and Kotzebue and Barrow and so on.
Did you have any idea when you were seeing the demand push at Carnegie Mellon University by these youngsters, these students who were hacking into your little experimental system there, that it was going to end up being something that would be in cafes? Because it seems from this point of view, it would have been possible to at least envision some of this. You talk, for instance, of one of the professors at CMU that wanted a wearable computer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we all have that now.
Absolutely. When I did lectures back in the day, I actually had a little mock-up Star Trek communicator. Remember the Star Trek communicator? That was a wearable computer communications device. And then people understood the vision. So we did talk about the vision of small computers and universal connectivity, anytime, anywhere, we called it. I don't know if we thought it would happen quite as fast as it did, but it was definitely out there as kind of a science fiction idea.
Well, I remember there was a certain point where they were trying to sell HDTV. You may recall this. That was the big market thing was to get a high density TV, and they were selling it, but there wasn't enough technology, and it was too expensive, and it just basically fizzled. Now it's all over the place. But at the time, it was said the United States is really slipping behind all these other countries, which have all sorts of handheld devices. And we did see that for quite some time. We still see quite a bit of it, where stuff that was developed in, say, Taiwan or Singapore or even Korea is in Japan, for sure, shows up as stuff we'd never seen before here.
You know, this...
And was customarily used.
This sounds a little...
Are we still behind?
Are we behind in this country?
United States, are we still behind? Are they still doing jazzier things in Singapore?
Well,
maybe even India.
I don't think we're behind in technology development. In fact, you know, we still have the best universities in the world in this country. So we've got Carnegie Mellon's, the MITs, and so on. And our high-tech R&D is still pretty vibrant. I think where a lot of the criticism comes about, and you even did a program recently on broadband deployment. So developing the technology is one thing, but getting it out there for people to use is a different dimension of the problem. And when you look at broadband deployment, there are several other nations that are ahead of us. And what I'm saying there is, if you just do a calculation like what percentage of the population has access to, pick a number, 1 megabit per second broadband service or something like that. I think one of the leading nations is Korea. Another one is Singapore. But they have a few things in their favor. For example, Singapore is a very densely populated place. So it's one thing to deliver broadband within a city, and it's another to do it out in the wide open spaces, which we do have some wide open spaces here in Alaska. But even as a nation, the United States is behind some of these other countries. Another thing about places like Korea and Singapore is they run their countries on much more of a top-down basis. So whereas in this country, at least in the telecom sector and in other sectors, we're more of a free market competitive orientation. In other words, the services will be deployed when the companies think that they can make a profit by deploying those services. But I think the last time I checked, in terms of broadband deployment, we were, the U.S. was somewhere between number 15 and number 20 in the world, which doesn't sound too good. But it is an area that's being emphasized. We had the stimulus package, which you talked about on a recent program. So there's some progress being made there. But I would distinguish that from actually developing the technologies. And a lot of the brain power that goes into that is still located in this country.
Well, I'm thinking just in terms of the cool devices. I mean, there's devices that I can't even conceive of that people are carrying around now. And they have apps that they haven't learned and probably won't learn 90% of them. And that's just kind of the direction that's going. You'll like this one here from Thorn Bay. This comes from Karen Peterson. Good morning. Here in Thorn Bay, we are still using radio phones in the Southside subdivision. By the way, hello to Dr. Hills. My parents and I had lunch with him in Valdivia, Chile. Valdivia?
That's right. That's where my university is in Chile.
About 6 years ago.
Uh-huh. I think that Karen and I were on the Red Cross Board of Directors together. Is Karen on the line or was that email?
No, that's an email one.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we were serving on a board together, and then one thing led to another, and they were on vacation. They came over to our house in Chile, and we had a great time.
Well, we still sometimes have to interview people on radio phone that are on boats and stuff like that.
Mm, there you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still a good technology as far as I can see.
Remember the satellite delay?
Oh, yeah. Every once in a while we get into that in broadcast. It's pure hell because people don't know when you're used to it, as we all used to be. It's sort of like you don't even have to say over, you know. But when you're not used to it, you really do need to say over.
You do need to say it's your turn to talk.
Let's go to Tanya, joins the program from Anchorage. You're on the air with Dr. Hills.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Very good.
I just wanted to mention that Dr. Alex Hill helped support a scholarship through the Center for Community Engagement, and I thought maybe he could say a couple words about that.
Yeah, being the Distinguished Service Professor at Carnegie Mellon University, I'm sure he would be more than happy to.
Thanks, and thanks for the question, Tanya. Tanya's talking about a UAA program, which we haven't talked about UAA yet, but the activity that I talked about earlier, working in developing nations and giving technology students a chance to work on projects, is now starting up in Alaska, too. And so I've been happy to be involved in even supporting an award over there where students are doing the same kind of thing, but here in Alaska. So at UAA, we have a couple of activities going on. One of them is through the Center for Community Engagement, where engineering and technology students work on projects right here in Alaska, but still with the same idea, to help nonprofits with their technology problems. And then, let's see, last term we did a project for the Matsu Ski Club to see if we could light their ski trails using renewable energy. And then just this past summer, I had a couple students working out in Unalakleet for the Bering Strait School District. So thanks for the question, Tanya.
Yeah, Tanya, doesn't the basically, if there were a nonprofit, let's say, that had a need for a geek squad, they might want to contact the center, right?
Yeah, they definitely should. It'd be a great idea. It's a really cool program that Alex Hill supports. It's really neat. Thanks for doing that.
All right, Tanya, thank you. And before we do any more email messages, I think we'll go ahead and take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
one 800 478 2555, our telephone number to connect with Alex Hills, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. But time's a-wasting here. We only got about 8 minutes. And Dr. Hills, I want to first off compliment you for your book, Wi-Fi and the Bad Boys of Radio. For me, and the many themes that I try and touch on in this program, this story that you tell in here cuts across a number of them, and one of them is what technology might be able to do for our future, and the notion of community service and the notion of our responsibility when we have increasing communication capacity to actually make it mean something, which I think is a difficult thing, and it's one of the reasons that I chose to go into community broadcasting, because it's important that our communications do mean something. So you have this compelling tale about RF. I don't know if anybody's ever actually written a whole book that is a story just about RF. And for many of our listeners, they have no idea. When I say RF, their eyes are glazing over already.
Radio frequency.
Yeah. But here is this book.
And it doesn't have any equations.
And the Bad Boys of Radio. Where did you get the idea to write this?
I think it's really an outgrowth of the writing that I've done for Scientific American and other similar publications.
Did somebody say, you know, you've been around so long, it's about time you write this all down? Seriously.
I don't know. I think it was just my idea.
Really?
I think it came out of that Scientific American.
And you thought, you know, we really need to tell this Wi-Fi story, and then you realized, oh, it really lines up with the Alaska stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are back in Alaska.
Well, I cut my teeth on RF here in Alaska, sort of figuring out what's going on with these radio signals, especially in that Bush telephone program, the one that used the VHF radios, because those radio well, first of all, what the Bad Boys do very much depends on what frequency you're at. Is it low frequency or high frequency? But those VHF radio phones that we used were at a frequency that's not too far away from Wi-Fi. VHF, very high frequency, and then Wi-Fi is at UHF, ultra high frequency. So the behavior is kind of the same. And in doing that Bush telephone program, we had to deal with the same kind of issues. And so that's where I learned my stuff. And so that's why the Alaska piece of this is so relevant.
Well, you've got book signings. I mean, this book is hot off the presses, right? I think you
first. Does it feel warm?
Well, not quite, but I think I can smell the printer's ink. And my first look at it was off a PDF that you were good enough to send to me. Mm-hmm. Now you've actually put one in my hands, but I don't think it existed like a week or so ago.
Right.
So these are hot off the presses. So where does a person get them? Are you doing signings? Tell me.
Well, where can a person get them? The first place you could go would be to my website, which is dralexhills.com. There's a complete description.
Is that D-R-A?
D-R-A.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And there's lots of information about the book there. You can also order it if you like. It's also available online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, BN.com. You can go to your local bricks and mortar bookstore. They'll probably have to order it for you. As far as events go, there are a couple of events that are scheduled here in Alaska. Well, more than a couple. On September 21st, I'll be speaking to the Greater Palmer Chamber of Commerce. That'll be out in Palmer at a lunchtime meeting. And then later the same day at Fireside Books, which is our little bookstore in Palmer. And it's really a great place. David Cheesham actually gave me a little bit of help with the editorial comments on the book.
He's got Wi-Fi, I believe, too.
I think he does, yeah. Yeah. So those two events are on the 21st of September, next Wednesday, the Palmer Chamber of Commerce at noon and the Fireside Books book signing event at 4 in the afternoon. Then I'll be headed back to Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon for a round of events back there. Then back to Anchorage, and there's an event that's being planned at UAA in mid-October, and the date is not yet set on that one, but that will be posted on UAA's website and all their various publications that they put out. So those are the ones that are scheduled right now.
All right, now to the email. This one from Kay Lawson. In 1971, Bob Merritt and Glenn Stanley at the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska in Town of College, installed a system for village health aides to conduct medical traffic. We were assigned specific hours for Alaskan use on the ATS-3 satellite. On the shelf, MICOR radios were installed in the health aides' homes, as most villages did not have clinics. Merritt had designed a helical antenna that was easy to deploy to the village in small planes. The battery could be charged by the school's generator, as that was the only source of AC power in most of our interior villages back then. The hospital in Tanana provided the physicians who talked with the health aides. I was privileged to travel to the interior villages where the radios were installed and met many wonderful health aides. As far as I know, this was the first proof of concept use of satellite communication network in Alaska. I believe that's right.
That's a great message, and it's one a little story that we talked about the other day, if you remember.
The helical.
For the listeners, a helical antenna is one that looks like a corkscrew. The deal here was that NASA built this satellite, and it was a satellite that was built so that it could be used with plain old taxicab radios. I mean, this was really low tech in terms of what you needed on the ground, and that was perfect for the application, and it was, as Kay said, it was exactly right. It was the first demonstration of the satellite communications and the application that it could have in Alaska villages. So Bob Merritt and Glenn Stanley were both professors at UAF. Glenn Stanley, kind of a radio propagation expert. Bob Merritt, a radio engineering expert, and they built these amazing antennas. I've got some photographs of them somewhere. And I think the year on that, Kay, you might remember, or did she say 1971 in her message? It was very early 70s.
Yeah.
And she got that exactly right, and it really was the breakthrough that showed us the light that satellite communications could do great things for the villages. And then we went on from there to the small earth station program that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, Merritt Helfrich chimed in on that one, too. And pretty much the same question, Alex. Do you remember the Institute's taxi radio experiments in
there
rural villages
yeah.
and health aids? Thanks, Merritt, for that. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking with Dr. Alex Hills. Just a couple of minutes left here. The telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And, gosh, I there are so many different places I would like to go with this. You know, I remember when public broadcasting was created, and it was created out of basically they did it for the TV. There was this educational TV, and they wanted to make something more out of it. And then they said, oh, we got to do something with radio, too. And suddenly the college radio stations became public radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in a sense, those earlier years when you were at Rensselaer, there was really more experimentation and more fun going on at the stations back then than when they sort of became all these NPR outlets and everything became serious.
And I know that you're a veteran of community radio in Pittsburgh, so the comment that you just made is very much in line with that philosophy. I always like to talk about the difference between our Bush public radio stations and the quote-unquote mainstream public radio stations, because back in the mainstream, starting in the late 60s and into the 70s, public radio was created as an alternative. The thinking was that, well, we've got all these commercial stations, they're programming to a mass audience, and they don't have economic incentives to program to a minority audience, which would be, for example, people that like classical music or folk music.
And Alaska, you just turned that totally on its head.
Turned it completely upside down, because in Alaska, we had a great need in rural Alaska, in western Alaska, and also in southeast Alaska, in the interior, for just a basic service. And so we took the public radio idea and just provided a basic service, which ended up, in some ways, sounding something like those commercial stations.
So in a sense, like we started out in the beginning of the show, we leapfrogged. And what you're discussing here, the taxi radio, that was leapfrogging. And finding technologies intended for one thing and putting it to work on something else. Do you think Alaska is still capable of that in the future? Do you think we can still leapfrog?
I think we've got great innovators up here.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got one of the things I like to say sometimes, if you want to get it done, give it to an Alaskan. Or you know, we weren't smart enough to know it was impossible, so we did it anyway.
Thanks so much for being with us, Alex Hills. Thanks also to Josh Edge and Dave Waldron. And next week on Talk of Alaska, we'll be talking about ecosystem-based management, if such a thing can even exist. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.